Welcome, everyone. I hope you enjoyed your break. We are going to jump right into our afternoon session. Our next presenter is Dr. Stephen Friedman, who's director of the Pancreas Center at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and chief of Division of Translational Research and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He has played a leadership role in clinical translational research at both institutions. Dr. Friedman is an internationally recognized leader in the areas of exocrine pancreatic disease with a particular focus on pancreatitis and cystic fibrosis. He leads an extensive research program that encompasses both basic science discovery as well as clinical trials. Today, he'll present Advancing the GI Frontier to People with CF. Welcome, Dr. Friedman.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here and to be able to talk about GI issues in patients with cystic fibrosis, because it's an area that hasn't gotten much attention, but as you'll see, it's something that we now need to address. This is my disclosure slide, and I'm funded from a number of sources, including NIH, pharma and biotech, foundations, including the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, and multiple philanthropic gifts to our program, where my lab can act as basically the NIDAS to take things from the bench all the way to the bedside and change the standard of care. I'm on a number of boards. I have no conflicts of interest for this presentation, other than I am on the scientific advisory board for development of a novel pancreatic enzyme at Sinspira. And I've had extensive grant funding to my institution from Alcresta, where I helped lead from beginning to end the studies on Relizorb and taking it to FDA approval. So what I'm going to talk about today is three aspects. First is, how common are GI symptoms in our patients with CF? And what should I look out for, whether I'm a provider, whether I'm a patient, whether I'm a mom or dad of an individual who has CF? Second is, how does understanding pathophysiology inform workup at the bedside and inform treatment strategies? And then finally, what's on the horizon for GI treatments in people who have CF? And do these highly effective modulators, such as Trikafta and others in the pipeline, equally work on the lungs as well as on the GI tract? So why focus on GI symptoms in people with CF? Well, first of all, we now have effective therapies for the lungs, including highly effective modulators. And as a result, we no longer need to be as lung-centric, because our patients are not suffering solely from the pulmonary manifestations of CF. We also realize the unmet need for addressing GI symptoms in people with CF. And living with GI symptoms shouldn't be part of living with cystic fibrosis. And I've heard over and over from my patients, well, I thought this is part of CF, living with abdominal pain, severe chronic constipation, horrible heartburn and reflux, and it shouldn't be the case anymore. And then finally, the value of an expanded multidisciplinary team where CF-trained gastroenterologists partnering with dietitians and the rest of the CF care team can play an important role, especially for adults, where if you're referred to a GI specialist who doesn't know much about CF, they tend to just recommend procedures, be interventional, and not providing that needed care that our patients truly need. First of all, in multiple queries now, it's very clear that GI symptoms are a top priority for both patients with CF as well as the parents of individuals who have cystic fibrosis. If it's not number one, it's a close number two that we really need to address the GI symptoms. And no matter what studies you look at, we all get the same results looking at the frequency of GI manifestations. Abdominal pain. So in the graph on the left here, adults data is in turquoise and pediatric data is in lavender. And you can see abdominal pain is present in up to 87% of our patients with CF. Similar number have flatulence, gas, abdominal distension, which severely impacts their daily lives. If you look at heartburn, it's anywhere up to 22 and up to 60% in adults who have CF. And if you now look at things like acid reflux, it's about a third to a quarter of our patients. Nausea, similar number. Severe constipation, vomiting. And you can see a pretty high prevalence that we're seeing in our patient population. So what I'm going to do over the next several minutes is address the GI manifestations that we see in CF. I'm going to work my way down gravity, starting with the upper GI tract, work our way down ultimately to the colon, talk about the liver and pancreas. I'll then get into increased risk for cancer in the GI tract, and then finally nutrition. And so we're going to walk our way through this, and we're going to focus on how do we work up symptoms, what tests are going to be helpful versus not helpful, and then what are treatment strategies that we have. So let's start in the upper GI tract, the stomach and esophagus. Gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, very common in our patients with CF. It's due to a lack of bicarbonate. If you don't have normally functioning CFTR chloride channel, you don't get enough bicarbonate secretion, and hence you can't neutralize acid made in the stomach. There's also decreased lower esophageal sphincter pressures. That's the valve at the end of your esophagus, and it's just lax in our patients with CF. And if it's lax and not staying tightly closed, except when we swallow and food has to go down, if it's always open, then acid and anything else can come right back up the esophagus and cause reflux symptoms. In addition, anyone with lung disease, there'll be increased negative pressures because of your lung disease, and that tends to cause acid to want to come on up into the esophagus. So why should we treat GERD? Well, number one is it causes symptoms. Heartburn is not a lot of fun, and we don't want people to walk around with heartburn to the point that's affecting their life. It's awakening them at 2-3 in the morning when we all make the most acid. We also know it can exacerbate lung disease when you have acid reflux. Even if you're not directly aspirating into the airways, it triggers these receptors and causes essentially like a spasm in your airways, worsening lung disease. And if you get a lung transplant, it tends to exacerbate disease in the transplanted lungs, which is why we focus on potentially anti-reflux procedures, anyone who's undergoing lung transplant. In addition, if you keep refluxing acid, after a while, the lining in your esophagus, which is called squamous mucosa, after a while it says, this doesn't feel so good. I'm tired of being irritated. And it changes the lining to be like the beginning of the intestine, the duodenum. And in fact, it's called intestinal metaplasia, and symptoms can go away. And you would think, wow, that's a great thing. That's very clever of Mother Nature. Problem is those cells are now unstable. It's called Barrett's esophagus and predisposes the cancer of the esophagus. So those are all the reasons to treat. Why shouldn't we treat? Well, these class of called proton pump inhibitors. These are drugs that we typically use to suppress acid production. They have names like Prilosec, Omeprazole, Pantoprazole, Prevacid. In a subset of individuals, they can accelerate bone loss called osteopenia and osteoporosis, which is already an issue in our patients with CF. So that's one issue. There's a theoretical risk of lung infection because if you don't have any acid production, it changes the bacteria in the GI tract and potentially in the airways, increasing risk of certain infections. And plus it's the pill burden. And I usually ask my patients, these are adults with CF, why are you on this acid blocker? And they say, well, I was put on it when I was a kid, never taken away. I don't know if I need it. We don't know if highly effective modulators such as Trikafta will improve reflux symptoms. Perhaps they do. And there's a study that's being activated looking at that. If someone has persistent symptoms of reflux despite our acid blocking therapy, then we'll consider an upper endoscopy called EGD, and we'll take a look and see if there's changes of esophagitis, of Barrett's esophagus. Sometimes we'll do what's called an impedance pH study, where we can actually directly look at whether or not you're refluxing things into your esophagus over a 24-hour period of time by putting this small tube down the esophagus. If we now move into the stomach, a third of our patients have paralysis of the stomach. We call it gastroparesis for stomach paralysis. A third of our patients. And we know that that CFTR, that chloride channel, is not only in the lining cells and regulates bicarbonate and mucus and fluid secretion, but it's in the nerves that regulate the motility, the contractions, these peristaltic waves in your GI tract. And hence, if CFTR is defective, you don't have normal motility and things become paralyzed in your GI tract. And a third of our patients, their stomach doesn't empty properly. They get full quickly. They may have a lot of nausea, vomiting. It's made worse if you have CF-related diabetes, especially if it's poorly controlled diabetes. We usually diagnose it by symptoms. You just get full with two bites of a meal. You may be losing weight, nausea, vomiting, especially of undigested food more than 4 hours after eating is a telltale sign. We sometimes do a stomach emptying scan. We look at the radioactive tracer added to a little bit of food and scan your emptying over 4 hours, but not the most sensitive or specific tests. If someone's having a lot of upper GI issues, we may do an upper endoscopy. We find, as you can see on this image on the left of one of my patients in April, there's all this undigested whitish, yellowish material because nothing is emptying from the stomach. And we do have treatments, a medicine called metoclopramide or Reglan, another medicine called domperidone, which is available in Europe and in Canada, or a newer medicine called prucalopride. So these are different treatment strategies we may use. What about in the small intestine? We're actually the host to the bacteria in our GI tract. We have 10 to the 17th bacteria once you finally get and look into the colon. 10 to the 17th, like the 17 zeros, that's a lot. So we're actually the host to the bugs, not vice versa. And if there's too many bacteria, or you have too many of the bad bacteria, then you can get what's called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or SIBO. We can see it in healthy people, diabetic folks, but very high prevalence, up to 50%, even may as high as 68% in our patients who have CF. Not so easy to diagnose. Sometimes we do these breath tests, look at hydrogen in your breath to tell us if you're making too many bugs. We can actually look at a blood test, something called folate levels. Turns out your bacteria, if you have too many, they make lots of folate, and the folate levels will be extremely high. And that can be a tip off. But usually we go by symptoms of bloating, gas, distension. And we have a number of treatments. There's a non-absorbable antibiotic called rifaximin or xifaxan. We sometimes use doxycycline, a tetracycline-like drug, or Flagyl, which is metronidazole. And we'll consider sometimes diets, such as diets that have foods that don't produce as much gas, like avoiding beans and things like that, or a lower carb diet. What about abdominal pain? Super common. Up to 80% of our patients with CF. And that's an extraordinary number. In fact, the CF Foundation has now convened a group of us to begin to work on guidelines and best practices on how to address just pain in our patients with CF, not just abdominal pain, but focusing on pain elsewhere throughout the body. When we're approaching a patient who has abdominal pain and has CF, you know, we have to take a careful history. Is this kind of relatively acute, or is this more chronic issue? Is it worse after eating to suggest that it's gallbladder issue? Maybe the gallbladder has to be removed, a pancreas issue. If it's better with food, that may suggest someone has an ulcer, and then we should be treating that or perhaps need an upper endoscopy. Where is the pain located in your abdomen? That tells us a lot about what organ is driving it. If it's kind of diffuse or around your belly button, then that's usually small bowel cause. If it's left lower quadrant, down low, then we're thinking more colon, or in the upper abdomen, is it stomach or duodenum? And if there's red flags, such as weight loss, blood in the stool, awakened in the middle of the night with the pain, that gets us concerned. And then for sure, we're going on an extensive evaluation looking for a cause. We can consider imaging. And we have lots of different imaging tests nowadays, ultrasound, CT, a certain kind of MRI called MRCP, which gives us a phenomenal view of everything in the abdomen and pelvis, but especially the pancreas and bile duct system. We can get a plain x-ray of your abdomen called a KUB. But here's the problem. What's normal in cystic fibrosis? And no one has really established what is truly normal. So if we see a dilated appendix, is that just what we would see in anyone with cystic fibrosis? Or does that tell us that the appendix is obstructed and it's acute appendicitis and someone needs to have it removed acutely? If we see inflammatory changes around the appendix, that would be a guide that, yes, it's acute appendicitis. But just a dilated appendix with mucus in there, that can be part of cystic fibrosis, just like a contracted, shriveled gallbladder. Or if you see stones. If you see cysts in the pancreas, pretty common. That's why it's called cystic fibrosis, because the original descriptions, Dorothy Anderson, many, many years ago, I believe in the 1940s, was you saw cysts in the pancreas. But yet, if a patient is referred to a general adult gastroenterologist who doesn't know CF, they get a CT scan, they see cysts in the pancreas, they're usually going after them, which is not usually a good thing. Scoping. When do we put a scope in? So upper endoscopy, colonoscopy, endoscopic ultrasound, another procedure called ERCP. And by the way, in GI, you can see we love things with initials. Importantly, will it change management? And us gastroenterologists who specialize in CF, we'll usually have a long discussion with a patient and their family about whether or not doing a procedure will make a difference in the care. What about just abdominal pain and we don't find a cause? We do have some other therapies. We want to use therapies that don't have a lot of side effects. There are anti-spasmodic agents that are kind of the zen for the GI tract, but they have what's called anticholinergic properties. They all thicken your secretions, and you can guess in a patient with CF, that's actually a bad thing, especially in the airway. And so we have things like peppermint oil capsules can work very good at spasm. Gabapentin, low dose, can help with abdominal pain when we don't find a clear cause. So let's now move to the colon. Constipation, very common. About a third of our patients with CF have it. A quarter, it is severe. I mean, severe to the point they're straining and it takes over their lives. I never had the appreciation. And once I started talking to my patients about how bad the constipation was, this really affects the quality of life. And there's a whole spectrum of constipation all the way up to potentially having obstruction. And in this KUB, this abdominal film on the side, all these air, you can see here, these are dilated loops of small bowel because there's an obstruction at the end of the ileum, the small intestine, because of thick secretions plugging it up called DIOS. So is a KUB, this plain film, ever helpful? I'm not so sure, because every time we get a plain x-ray, a KUB of someone's abdomen or SCF, this is what we get. We see the colon with all this material here, with black around its air, this whitish material here. That's all stool. They're full of stool. We always get that back, full of stool. That's part of CF. So is that helpful? If someone has chronic constipation, usually we think about things in a couple different categories. First is hydration. So just in their diet. So taking enough fluids, adding salt to their diet, just like in the airways, we want to give hypertonic saline to hydrate the secretions in your airway and thin them out. The same thing in the GI tract, fluids, salt, that actually helps. We'll give things like Miralax, also hydrates the stool. makes it easier to pass the stool, not be constipated, or lactulose sometimes. We're not so sure about medicines like amitiza, which is lubiprostone. Outside of CF, it does help with chronic constipation. Not so clear, since it partially needs a working CFTR chloride channel. We're not so sure if it helps our patients who have CF and constipation. But in a small subset, it does seem to help. But we'll consider Senna or newer medicines like prucalopride, which is Motegrity, placanotide, which is Trulance. And these two drugs theoretically help with abdominal pain, at least in the setting of people who have irritable bowel syndrome who have chronic constipation. And rarely patients may undergo an ACE procedure where there'll be a little tiny tunnel tract put over near the appendix in what's called the cecum. And patients with CF can put a little tiny rubber tube called a catheter in there twice a week and basically put in liquid and flush out the colon. What about the flip side, diarrhea? We know that meds can do it, antibiotics for sure. Some patients who are on Trikafta, that can be associated, especially in the first month or two, with diarrhea. It seems that our patients with CF are at perhaps slightly increased risk for celiac disease, which is kind of like a gluten allergy. Perhaps there's a slightly increased risk of Crohn's disease as well in our patients who have CF. So let's now turn to the liver. There's two forms of liver disease in CF. One is one that we have been aware of for many years. It's cirrhosis of the liver, usually occurs in early childhood. And usually by the time you hit puberty, if you're gonna get it, you already have cirrhosis by then. And it's due to the plugging of the bile ducts. And in this image on the right, you can see this yellowish brown material, which is plugging of the bile ducts, and you can get scarring, which is cirrhosis of the liver. We know that if you have what's called alpha-1 antitrypsin, that there's a 7-fold increased risk for developing cirrhosis, but that's only present in about 9% of all of our individuals who have CF and go on to cirrhosis. Mike Narkowitz and his team have led what's called the PUSH trial, very exciting, where they've been trying to define biomarkers that predict who will develop advanced CF liver disease, hence cirrhosis. And what they found is that if you look at ultrasound, the liver, and this is not just a radiologist who just does ultrasound, these are specially trained, very specific criteria for a research trial. And what they found is that under those conditions, if you have a heterogeneous or nodular ultrasound pattern of your liver, it correlated with developing cirrhosis of the liver. What we're now realizing is that there's another form of liver disease we can see in CF, and it occurs generally in our adults, maybe late teens, but usually in adults. And it's not cirrhosis, it's not scarring of the liver, but rather it's a vein problem. You can see this vein here, this large structure, and in the middle, it should be white space, and it's not. It's this obliterative venopathy that you develop that's called nodular regenerative hyperplasia. So it plugs up the veins, blood flow backs up, and you get portal hypertension. And for that, you can do what's called a shunt. And for those of you who are trying to figure out, so what does that mean? The blood's backing up. So here's your liver in this cartoon. Here's the portal vein that brings the blood to your liver. And if you have cirrhosis of the liver or you have this venopathy, obliterative venopathy, pressures build up in the portal vein. And as a result, the pressures build up, the spleen becomes enlarged here. All these little small veins become very dilated, and those are varices. And that's why in people with portal hypertension, the spleen's enlarged, you can have variceal bleeds, and you can do a spleno-renal shunt, connect this to this system and bring the pressures down and the patients can get better. Trikafta in the liver. So can I use Trikafta in liver disease? If you don't have liver disease, we'll get LFTs, liver blood tests, before starting the drug, every 3 months during the first year of treatment, annually thereafter. dosing, we interrupt it. If your transaminases, call ALT and AST, are more than 5 times the upper limit, or if your bilirubin goes more than twice the upper limit, then ALT or AST, 3 times the upper limit or higher. And then we'll see if you stop the drug, liver blood tests get better, then we decide, do we restart or not? Generally, if someone has liver disease, if it's mild cirrhosis called Child's A, no need for decreased dosing. Child's B or C, more advanced cirrhosis, usually will not start Trikafta. If so, then it would be reduced dose. And we're checking the liver blood test monthly for the first 3 months, then every 3 months thereafter. Pancreas. As you all know, majority of our patients, greater than 90%, have exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. And there's a lot of damage to the pancreas in utero before you're even born if you have CF. We thought that this was irreversible, but the arrival and climb study showed that with ivacaftor, you went from very low levels of fecal elastase, so essentially fully exocrine pancreatic insufficient. But after 84 weeks, you approached almost that cutoff of, which is normal fecal elastase. So you can recover at least up to age 5. We don't know beyond that. We're studying that with the PROMISE study, which I'll get into in a few minutes here. You know, probably after, once you're in your teens or adult, not so clear you can rescue acinar cell function because you've lost all those cells and they've been replaced by fat. We're realizing we can adjust pancreatic enzyme doses, even if we haven't rescued part of your pancreas. We were probably over-treating many patients with very, very high doses of pancreatic enzyme because we were treating the pancreatic insufficiency, but also the fact that the intestine isn't able to take up nutrients. And the secretions are so thick in the intestinal lumen. Now that things like Trikafta are improving intestinal function, we can recalibrate our PERT dosing here. Pancreatitis, a small subset of our patients with CF, can have recurrent acute or chronic pancreatitis. And we had published a retrospective small study in 2018. This may be prevented with highly effective modulators. I mentioned before a little bit about pancreatic cysts. Pancreatic cystosis, just cysts related to CF, is present in at least 8% of our patients who have cystic fibrosis. You can get other kinds of cysts called cystadenomas. You can have precancerous conditions called IPMN, and rarely you can have conditions such as IPMN, which goes on to pancreatic cancer. Very, very rare someone has pseudocysts, which is associated with recurrent or chronic pancreatitis. I'm just going to put this up. This is kind of late-breaking data. There's now several case reports, patients being on Trikafta, that if you actually improve, for example, the exocrine pancreatic disease, and these actually were teenagers, and one, I believe, was in their early 20s, and we publish, I believe, soon. And what they found is that in patients where they actually rescued their fecal elastase, went from essentially super low to that cutoff at 200 micrograms or gram of stool, that there's several case reports those individuals develop pancreatitis. Maybe because you only partially start to unplug the ducts and now you trigger pancreatitis. Very rare, but something to be on the lookout for. And the same thing in the gallbladder. 0.4% overall of our patients with CF getting cholecystitis, which is inflammation of the gallbladder. But there's a recent case report series. Within the first 4 weeks starting Trikafta, patients develop all of a sudden acute onset of right upper quadrant pain, and their liver blood tests were abnormal, and they had acute inflammation of the gallbladder. Presumably because now the gallbladder is all of a sudden contracting, all that thick inspissated material in it was trying to come out, block the duct out of the gallbladder called the cystic duct, plug things up, and it's acute cholecystitis. Rare, but to be on the lookout for. Cancer risk in CF, specific to the GI tract, 6-fold increased risk of colon cancer. If you've had a lung transplant because of the immune suppressing drugs, 25-fold. And you know, the majority of our patients, this is a study, if look at just asymptomatic individuals with CF, get a screening colonoscopy. 50% will have polyps that predispose to cancer. 3% of patients who had no symptoms, age 40, getting a screening colonoscopy, already were starting to develop colon cancer. And there's an increased risk of cancers in the other part of the GI tract, esophagus, pancreas, bile duct, small bowel. And as a result, colonoscopy guidelines were created, and we want to pick up called adenoma polyps before they ever go on to cancer. And now we recommend screening if a patient with CF has no symptoms at age 40, every 5 years thereafter, unless you have polyps, and then it's probably every 3 years. And if you had a lung transplant, it's within 2 years after a transplant here. We don't know if highly effective modulators at Cycrafta are going to change this risk and bring it down or not. We'll see. Why is there an increased risk of colon cancer and GI tract cancers? Well, the microbiome, the bugs in your GI tract are altered. We give our patients with CF very high fat diets, which we know increases risk in the general population of having colon cancer. And the CF gene, when it's working normally, is an anti-cancer gene. And so when it's defective, you lose that tumor suppressor aspect here. With the CF Foundation, there's a group of us now heading up with Sarah Jane Schwarzenberg and Christine Hacham looking at whether or not there's other screening tests besides colonoscopy that identify who really needs colonoscopy, looking for microscopic blood in the stool or Cologuard. Nutrition, I think most people are aware that early nutrition impacts health, and your nutritional status at age 4 predicts your lung disease at age 18 and your survival rate. And as a result, there are now evidence-based nutrition guidelines created in 2008. A group of us put together the enteral feeding guidelines in 2016, when people should have feeding tubes, how to treat other causes of nutritional failure, and what to be on the lookout for. I helped develop this ex vivo pancreas in a cartridge called Relizorb. So if you're on tube feeds, since taking pancreatic enzyme capsules by mouth doesn't really do much if you're on tube feeds, this is a way to digest whatever's in that feed and improve absorption here. We don't know if highly effective modulators may decrease the need for G-tubes or GJ tubes. We're starting to see what seems to be the case, that fewer people need to still have their tubes, but we'll see in over time, in the next couple of years, if that's the case. CFTR modulators, they have a number of ways they impact nutrition. They drive increase in appetite. They decrease energy expenditure by decreasing your lung disease. So you're not essentially on the treadmill, so to speak, where you're burning calories. It increases bicarbonate secretion and fluid secretion, so you can digest and absorb things better in the GI tract and improve motility and have less inflammation in the gut. And all these things drive increased nutrient uptake. It may explain, at least in part, why on Trikafta, many of our patients with CF show dramatic increases in their weight. Some people, so much so that obesity is now becoming an issue. And we're now trying to take nutritional outcomes to the next level. And there's a group of us who are working together to look at other markers beyond BMI that reflect nutritional status in our patients with CF, whether it's DEXA scans, markers of muscle called sarcopenia, molecular readouts. We can now do something called metabolomics, and in part also shifting the high quality diets where our dietitians are now looking beyond just total fat, total carbs, but looking at individualizing approaches to our patients with CF, especially in this era of highly effective modulators. In the last couple of minutes, I'm going to just talk about two initiatives that are trying to change the landscape of the GI frontier in CF. First is a program that I helped developed with colleagues through the CF Foundation in 2014 called DIGEST. It stands for Developing Innovative Gastrointestinal Specialty Training. But our goal was to train dedicated CF pediatric and adult GI faculty across the United States. We started this in 2014. Every 2 to 3 years, we take a new group. Dr. Sarah Jane Schwarzenberg helps me run this program. We run it together. She's pediatric GI, University of Minnesota. And we've now trained over 50 people. We're now worldwide, and we're creating clinical experts in the CF aspects related to GI. And our goal is to also educate other gastroenterologists and providers to ensure optimal care. There's three pillars to our program. Everyone has to be in a CF clinic at least half a day a month. We have monthly webinars. And when we started this in 2014, we were the first, I think, around the world to already be using virtual formats on a monthly basis. And also many of the individuals in Digest do scholarly projects to advance our knowledge. One of the outputs of the Digest program was to publish a 10-article CFGI series in the Journal of CF back in November 2017. It's what we know, what we don't know, and current best practices in the GI aspects of CF. I believe there's been over like 100,000 downloads of that 10-article series. And we're also developing a visiting scholar program where we're having people in Digest to go to different programs now. For the moment, it's obviously virtual with COVID, but eventually in person, go to programs that don't have a Digest person and help guide and help with disseminating our knowledge. And then finally, our research initiatives. So how can we advance our knowledge for our patients and family? And the first question is, excuse me, so what's that intestinal FEV1 equivalent in the GI tract? And we haven't really had anything, like just having people say, yes, I'm more constipated. But how can we have an objective readout? And our first study was called Galaxy, 402 children and adults across the whole age spectrum enrolled at 26 centers. And it was looking at just on your smartphone, electronic patient reported outcome measures or EPROM. On your smartphone, there was a dedicated questionnaire that we had input, including from families and patients with CF. And our goal was to define prevalence and variability of GI symptoms and whether or not people could do this on a weekly basis on their smartphone or a tablet or electronic device. First study, believe it or not, to use this through the TDN, about 78% of all subjects completed this study, finished 4 months start to finish. And these were the questionnaires. They were upper and lower GI symptoms on the left, quality of life measures related to constipation. What did your stool look like, called the Bristol Stool Scale? And then finally, disease-specific questions. And we're now launching other studies now that that's been successful. There's the PROMISE trial you may have heard of, and several of us are involved in this, and it's looking pre and up to 2 years post real-world use of Trikafta. Sarah Jane Schwarzenberg and I are looking at the GI manifestations, Mike Narkowitz, liver, and we're looking at everything from symptoms to GI tract inflammation, body composition, bugs in the GI tract called the microbiome, pancreatic function, liver disease, and intestinal pH in transit. And finally, you know, this is an exciting time. It's not so clear that Trikafta, which has enormous impact on the lung disease, not so clear it's having a similar positive impact on the GI tract so far. But we have a number of readouts that I think is going to be enormously helpful as pharma and biotech companies are looking at drugs in the pipeline. We can create on a little piece of a rectal biopsy, what's called organoids, basically recreate your intestine in a culture dish and look at how these modulators or other drugs improve CFTR. Or smart pill, looking at transit time in the GI tract, or pH, or markers of inflammation, looking at metabolites, and looking at these patient-reported outcome measures. So, you know, to summarize, I think this is such an amazing time, and we've realized the GI manifestations, now that we've gotten so much better at addressing lung disease, the GI tract is the next important frontier to address. And we can now expand that multidisciplinary team, especially as survival is extended, by adding a CF doc. And in fact, we've been the model as Digest for other specialties, such as Envision for training endocrinologists to deal with CFRD. We know that GI symptoms are very common and impact daily quality of life. And identifying a GI physician as a focal point is really important. And whether it's a local Digest person or a Digest visiting professor, visiting your site here. And then finally, the GI tract. We know from a lot of other models that GI tract, if there's inflammation there and abnormalities, it's the driver of disease in other organs, such as the airway. I'd like to thank you for your time and happy to address any questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Friedman. Time for questions now. And with that, I will pass it over to Siri.
Thank you, Jim. Dr. Friedman, that was an incredible presentation, so full of information. And my only thing that is heartbreaking to me is that we only have about 6 minutes of questions before we go to the memoir presentation. So for those of you who have given questions, we'll do some quick back and forth with them. But I assure you, Dr. Friedman has already told me he will respond to these questions afterwards and we will get the answers out to everyone. So thank you in advance. So starting from the top, and I hope I pronounced this correctly, can you tell me about appendiceal mucosal?
Common CF? So it can be common. There's a very, very rare version that actually is precancerous, but you know, you can have basically mucus plugging of the appendix, very common. And that's where you need someone who's trained, either as a surgeon or gastroenterologist, to know when is this truly reflecting acute inflammation of the appendix and consider surgery.
Is a fatty pancreas normal in CF?
Very normal. It's what we characteristically see, especially adults who have CF, that over time, fat just replaces the normal exocrine parts of the pancreas. It doesn't mean anything bad, but generally means that there's no exocrine pancreatic tissue left.
From what you've seen, do the bowel movement changes happen on all modulator therapies or specifically to the Trikafta combo?
So it's variable how much Trikafta helps the bowel movements, whether it's chronic constipation, whether it's a side effect of diarrhea. I wish I was out of business because Trikafta resolved everyone's constipation. I don't usually see that to any great degree. So it's variable. I've had some people on Ivacaftor who their constipation improved. I think for the most part, at least in adults with CF, I haven't seen a large impact of Trikafta on the bowel movement pattern.
Several questions related to colon cancer and screening. Is there going to be recommendations on behalf through the CFF about lowering the age of screening for people with CF in light of the fact now it's 45, right, for the general population to be screened? And I will say just this week, a 34-year-old friend of mine with CF was diagnosed with colon cancer. So it is an issue. And along with the screening, somebody else asked, should carriers also be screened earlier?
Wonderful questions. I could probably talk for 20 minutes on this. I'll try to be brief. But the bottom line is, I think we don't know if carriers are at increased risk for colon cancer. As a scientist, I would think maybe that's the case because you've lost some of the tumor suppressing part. No one has studied that. Actually, my group is kind of interested in it. As far as patients with overt CF, should we start screening at a younger age? Yeah, the age has come down to 45 in the general public. Not unreasonable to be thinking about that. On the flip side is, you know, it's with everything that a patient with CF has to do and go through, the prep is the hard part. It's like a 3-day clean out and it is tough to go through. So yes, I think it's worthwhile thinking about that. I think right now we're just trying to get everyone screened at least by age 40. And if you had a lung transplant 2 years after that, there are case reports in the literature as young as age 19, a patient with CF presenting with rectal cancer. So it's an issue, but it's tough prep. As a result, the CF Foundation, there's a group of us, as I mentioned, who are now looking at what if we look for microscopic blood called the FIT test, and what about Cologuard? So we're going to look at whether or not that's something maybe should be done annually. I don't know what age, but start at a much younger age. And then if that's positive, yes, at a minimum, that should trigger colonoscopy before age 40. But we need data and we're going to be studying that.
Thank you. Any recommendations besides taking drugs like Fosamax for osteoporosis?
Yeah, I'm not the expert in this area. You know, there are a number of other drugs, Prolia and things like that. You know, talk to your endocrinologist. You know, I think it's clearly, especially I talked about the GI frontier, there's the endocrine frontier as well. So others could probably be talking about that also. And that includes not only CF-related diabetes, but we know osteopenia, thinning of the bones, osteoporosis, which is more severe bone loss, are major issues in CF, especially due to the chronic inflammation in this condition. And address it early, talk to your, you know, talk to someone who's focusing on it and getting DEXA scans as well.
Knowing, as you mentioned, that proton pump inhibitors, that many people were started as children and really have never questioned or altered from that. And in light of the bone loss that occurs with that, would you recommend that adults, are they, you know, to go off and use them if they're having issues with reflux? What are the recommendations moving forward?
So my personal approach is we shouldn't use drugs, CF or no CF. We shouldn't use medications or drugs on patients unless we know that the benefit far outweighs the risk. So we mostly want to use these drugs. This is my personal bias. Maybe some others have different opinions, but you know, if someone's having heartburn or acid reflux symptoms, or there's evidence, even if someone doesn't have symptoms, that they're having significant reflux affecting their airway and lung function. So maybe they have manometry or they're approaching lung transplant or have had a lung transplant. You know, in those conditions, then yes, you probably need to be on some acid blockade, maybe a proton pump inhibitor. And if you need to be on it because of symptoms or protecting your lungs and preserving lung function, then you should be getting DEXA scans, or at least someone should be assessing bone loss. Not everyone on a proton pump inhibitor gets bone loss, only a small subset, and we're not so good at predicting who. If you have zero symptoms, I usually tell people, stop the proton pump inhibitor if you've been on it since being a kid, and if you don't need it anymore, or if you're a young person and, you know, pediatric and you're on a highly effective modulator, maybe not unreasonable to stop it and see how you do, and then decide, is it really something that's part of your armamentarium? Usually the number one issue for patients with CF and their family members is pill burden is too high and GI manifestations are a close second. So anything that gets at both of those, including the pill burden, is probably helpful.
And very last question, and then we have to go, sadly. How does a person find a CF-trained GI physician?
Yeah, I think ask, you know, talk to your pulmonologist and your CF care team. They're aware of our whole digest group. We tend to be mostly on the East and West Coast and a few scattered places in between in Texas. But, you know, talk to your care team. They'll know how to reach out to us, which is not uncommon. Anyone's welcome to reach out to me as well. I'm at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. I'm also part of our Boston Children's Hospital, Brigham and Women's Adult CF team. Lots of people email me from around the world. I never mind. And whether you're a provider, whether you're a patient, whether you're a parent, always happy to chat. Anything that makes you better.
Thank you so much. And that is what we all wish. Your patient-centric perspective is just so wonderful to hear. And we're so grateful to you for sharing your time, your expertise. I'm hoping we can impose to bring you back another day for a podcast or something. There's so much more information to cover. Everybody else, we will share the questions with Dr. Friedman and post the responses to them. But thank you so much for this incredible presentation.
Thank you. Very much appreciate it.